I started reading a series of books when I was in high school. It was a fiction series, and each book took about a year for the author to come out with it. I initially thought it was only going to be three books, a trilogy. And after the end of the third book, I realized he was going to write at least one more, and he wrote one more. And after the end of that fourth book, I thought he's going to write at least one more, and he wrote one more. And I thought, surely the next one will be the last book, and it was not. He wrote one more and one more, and then he died, never finishing the series. And I got really angry because I really wanted to read the end of this series of stories that I'd invested so much time in, and I couldn't. A few weeks ago, I went to the movies, and about halfway through the movie, I was by myself. Sometimes I go to the movies by myself, and I enjoy it, and I was watching this movie, and it was a really good movie. And about halfway through the movie, I got a text, and I made the mistake of reading the text, and I was like, oh, I just need to make it through the movie before I respond. And then the same person who texted me called me, and I'm like, I just can't put this off. And so I left the movie halfway through. It was at this crucial part where the story was just ramping up, and the movie was beautiful. It was maybe one of the most beautiful movies I've seen in the last 10 years. And it was so good, and I just wanted to finish it because I just knew that the movie's ending was going to be so great. But I left the movie halfway through and didn't finish watching it. And I was so mad because I wanted to see how the story ended. When we read stories, we see those stories because we want to see the ending. We want to see a happy and good ending. Most of us do, anyway. You want that good ending. You want that, for a story to be truly good, it has to have a very good ending. I think that every single one of us wants that, to see the end of a story, to see the words, and they lived happily ever after. Whether you are a man or a woman, you long for a great and epic ending, that happy fairy tale ending. There's that longing in all of us for something better and greater and beautiful. Now that longing may get worn down by the passage of time, and as we get older, at least as I've gotten older, I've noticed that cynicism creeps in, and a certain level of jadedness creeps in, and our life experiences kind of wear us down, and we maybe no longer dream of that perfect ending. And I'm convinced no matter how jaded we become and how cynical and how bitter, we still, deep, deep down, sometimes very deep down, long for that perfect and beautiful ending. In a lot of old stories, old fairy tales and Disney movies, the stories end with a wedding. The princess marries the prince, and they all live happily ever after. And for good reasons, those stories end that way. Weddings are celebrations of life and future hope. Now, I've been at weddings where the bride and the groom are getting married. Everybody is so happy. It's beautiful. It's perfect. And then somebody says in a grumpy, been there, done that kind of voice, well, just wait a few years. They won't be so happy then. And you may be thinking that right now. You may be thinking, oh, that's happily ever after is just BS. It's not real. So I'm asking you just suspend that inner jaded voice, that inner calloused voice for a moment. Because weddings are a celebration of life and future hope and potential. And our psalm today catches that. It is a wedding psalm. It's a royal wedding, to be exact. It's actually the only explicit wedding psalm in the Bible. It is unique in its style and its focus. We see at the very beginning of this psalm just a few details. In the title itself, and I've talked about this in the past, The titles in the Psalms are important to the Psalms themselves. Often we'll skip over those titles because we're trying to get to the meat of the Psalm itself, but for many throughout history in the church, the title, the superscript, was just as important as the rest of Scripture. In fact, in the Hebrew Scriptures, the title is often the first verse. So many of the Hebrew Scriptures, when they're in Hebrew, your Psalms have one extra verse because it's that title verse. They're important. They're very old. In some cases, as old as the Psalm itself. So they should be kept with the Psalms and not left out. But they tell us really important things. Historical details, sometimes. Sometimes they tell us something important that we need to know. And so practically, we should read those when we read the Psalms. This one starts off, like many of them do, for the director of music, to the tune of the lilies. We're not sure what the lilies is or was. We just know that it's probably another song, and the psalmist is being clued in to how this psalm should be sung or canted. We also learn that it's of the sons of Korah. Whether they wrote it or it was written in a style that they had developed or set in place, we don't really know. We also learn that it's a maskil, which we don't really know what that is either, other than it's maybe a style of psalm or a way of reading. But then we get to a part that's really important. We see that it's a wedding song. Literally, though, it reads in the Hebrew, a love song. It's a love song. A love song for who and from who? Well, the short answer is it's a love song for the main character in the psalm, which is the king, and secondarily, his bride-to-be. And it's written by this psalmist, who we don't exactly know who it is. And we really don't even know who the king is and who the bride is. There's a lot of ink that's been spilled on theories of who it is, and some of them are pretty ludicrous, and some of them are maybe fair guesses. But who is the psalmist writing about? And that's the great question that we should explore for a few minutes before we move along further. I want to make another side note, and that side note is we need to go to a place in the New Testament to set the stage for how we read some of the psalms that we see and that can help us. We need to go to a place in the New Testament of the Bible and read something that happened to some disciples on the afternoon of Jesus' resurrection. These two guys are heading from Jerusalem to Emmaus. They're talking about a bunch of things that have happened. But the thing that has occupied the majority of their conversation was about Jesus, about his death, and the fact that some of the women that were associated with them had gone to the tomb that morning, and at the tomb they'd noticed that Jesus' body was missing. They'd reported back to the other disciples that Jesus was gone, and so they were talking about it. And while they're talking about it on the road to Emmaus, Jesus comes up to them. And he starts to talk to them, and they don't recognize him. They don't know that it's Jesus. And they have this conversation about all the things that have happened and how disappointed they are because they thought that Jesus was the chosen one, that he was the one that was going to redeem Israel, that he was going to save Israel. And then Jesus tells them that they're being foolish. And in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24, verse 27, we're told this: "And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, Jesus explained to them what was said in all of the scriptures concerning himself." This is important because Jesus is talking about Moses, the first five books of the Bible, and all the prophets, all the prophetic utterances in the scriptures that point to something that's going to happen. And he says, all of these things that you've been steeped in and that you've read all your life are pointing to me, are pointing to Jesus Christ himself. These guys later exclaimed to others, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" Jesus opened the scriptures so that they could see and understand something that they couldn't see and understand before. There are many scriptures in the Bible that carry a double meaning. Very, very many scriptures. Very many psalms that carry a double meaning. There are many stories in the Bible that carry a double theme. The near horizon and the far horizon. Here's how I like to think of it. So, everybody hold up your finger in front of your face. You got to do it. I know it feels silly. Do it. So I want you to focus on your finger. And when you focus on your finger, what happens to me? I get blurry, right? I'm still here. You can still hear me, but I'm a little blurry. But when you focus on me, what happens to your finger? It gets blurry. I'm still here, or it's still there, but it's just less visible. The near horizon and the far horizon. It's still there. It's still part of what you're seeing, but it's less clear. The near horizon is what the people who wrote the scriptures saw. It's what they experienced. It's what our psalmist writes. It's what he experiences. The far horizon is what the Holy Spirit intended for us to see at a later time. The Psalms are full of these double meanings. Every psalm, really, is full of these double meanings. We know this and we see this because the way in which Jesus himself thought about the Psalms. He quoted the Psalms many times throughout his life, probably more than we even read in the Gospels, and he used them to refer to himself. Psalm 22, Psalm 110, Psalm 118, just to name a few. So when we come to any psalm that we read, we really need to have our antennas open and ready to receive and see what else can we see. The near horizon, the finger in front of our face, but also the far horizon, the thing beyond the finger in our face. But how do we know if what we're reading has a double meaning? How do we know that we're not overstretching or making things up? How do we know to read parts of Psalms like that? Well, our psalm today actually helps us, gives us some tips. Start with the biggest help we get, and that is, we had this help last week too, and that is, where else is this psalm quoted? Where else is it used? And what is the person who's quoting it using it to say? If we look in other places in the Bible where the psalm is quoted, you'll see that it's often used in a different way than what it was written about. And if you see our psalm today, if you look at it, you will see that the writer of Hebrews quotes Psalm 45 in Hebrews 1, chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. And he quotes it to talk about Jesus. He quotes this psalm. And more specifically, he quotes this psalm to show that the king that the psalmist writes about is King Jesus. So we see the New Testament writers understanding this double meaning. The second is that sometimes the psalmist will say things about humans, and in the context of the psalm, that doesn't make sense in a purely human context. These references will be full of elevated language and carry messianic hints to them. In our text, we see it throughout. The picture that our psalmist paints of this king is one that is impressive and almost otherworldly. It could be excused as an overly enthusiastic poet, an overly enthusiastic exaggeration, except for in verses 6 through 7. In the midst of praising the king, the psalmist suddenly slips into conflating the king and God together. No king in any of Israel could carry the weight of this kind of praise, except perhaps the messianic king. So if we read Psalm 45, just as a wedding song, written for the king and the bride, then we miss something really important. But if we read it as that second double meaning, then we see something that's really beautiful. It becomes a song. Becomes a song about Jesus and his bride, the church. So hold that thought in your mind for just a second. No, I'm throwing a lot at you this morning, so bear with me. Weddings back in the day, back in those days in biblical times, were a little different than what we expect today. In biblical times, weddings were long, drawn-out affairs. They were often marked by long engagements that carried as much weight as a formal marriage. Often, there was a betrothal ceremony a year, 2 years sometimes, in advance of the actual wedding day. And the betrothal was legally as binding as a marriage. The only things that you didn't get to do after you were betrothed was sex and living together. So somebody would become a betrothed to get married, and then they would have a period of time where their betrothal was, it carried the full weight legally as a regular marriage. There are some practical reasons for that. One of those is that it was often, well, it was all the time, the father of the bride would set a price for a bride price for the marriage. And so the man who was marrying would have to get the money together to meet that bride price, whatever that would be. It could be livestock or gold or whatever. And the more valuable that the father felt his daughter was, the higher that price would be. And so sometimes there would be the guarantee of the wedding by the betrothal so that the man could gather the amount of money for the bride price. And when he did that, they would set the date for the actual wedding. And the wedding would sometimes be weeks long. We think of weddings nowadays as one day. You got an hour. Let's get this done and let's get out of here so we can party. The wedding would be that, but also a lot of partying and a lot of different stages of the wedding. In the betrothal, if you wanted to break off the marriage, you had to actually pursue a divorce. We see that with Joseph and Mary. When he found out that she was with child, he determined to divorce her. They had not yet consummated their wedding, but they were in that period of time. And so we see that picture of marriage and a wedding in this psalm, and we're capturing the moment that the betrothal is over and they are moving into the wedding ceremonies. And it was typical for the man to go to where the groom to go to where the bride was, which was the father's house. And part of the wedding ceremony was to go and get the bride and bring her back to his house where the ceremony would be completed. And then there would be a lot of partying for days and weeks. We see that in John 2 when Jesus is at the wedding in Cana. And so we see the moment that the betrothal is over and the wedding ceremony is to begin. And we see the king. We see the king standing in all his regal glory and all his wedding day finery. And the psalmist's heart is stirred in verse 1. It's stirred because the king is a picture of what every king should be. Perfect in speech, verse 2. Mighty for battle, verse 3. Standing forth for the greatest of virtues, truth, humility, and justice, in verse 4. Powerful over all other nations, verse 5. Representing the everlasting throne of God with justice and righteousness and good, verse 6 and 7. And he is arrayed with the pomp and splendor of a kingdom of wealth and beauty. Even his servants are the daughters of kings. This is a king of kings. And in the place of honor, clothed in the most precious of gold, is the bride. And then we see the psalmist turn his attention to the bride, and he offers advice to this bride to be, turn to your new husband. with all the loyalties you would give to your father and your family, now given to your husband, the king, in verses 10 and 11. And because of your husband, the king, because of your place as the bride, then even the wealthiest and most powerful nations, like Tyre, will honor you and seek your favor. And then the psalmist switches from talking to the bride to talking about the bride. And this bride is beautiful. She has been made beautiful in anticipation of this great and glorious day when she will be led into the palace of the king, where she will be with him in joy and gladness. Verses 13 through 15. And then there's a promise to them both that the generations of children born will rule throughout the land. And then the psalmist in verse 17 goes back to himself, and he's so moved by the scene, he declares that he will perpetuate the king's memory through all generations. Therefore, the nations will praise the king forever and ever. Now, as I went through that, could you see the double meaning there? Could you maybe just picture that a little bit? Jesus is the perfect king. His lips have been anointed with grace. Over and over again in the Gospels, we see that. In Luke chapter 4, we see that the people were amazed at the gracious words that flowed from the lips of Jesus. John chapter 6, many people who had been following Jesus for some time, they were disciples of Jesus. They heard some hard teaching, and it bothered them, and they left Jesus. And Jesus turns to his remaining disciples, the 12, and he says, "Are you going to leave me now?" And Peter answers, he says, Where would we go? You have the words of life. The words that come from Jesus' lips give life, grace, and blessing. He is mighty in battle and expounds the greatest of virtues, yet his might is not found in the sword, like so many kings, but in his reliance upon God the Father. In Matthew, as Jesus is being arrested and his disciples are quick to pick up the sword to fight, Jesus says, "Do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" But he chooses a different way, a plan that has been in place for ages and ages. And amidst the lies, Jesus stands for what is true. And where there is pride, Jesus embodies humility, and where there is injustice, Jesus proclaims justice, and the nations will fall at his feet. As Paul, quoting Isaiah, says of Jesus, every knee will bow before him, and every tongue will confess him. And his throne will be a forever throne, from which the rule over all creation is a rule of beauty and righteousness, where no wickedness will exist. All that was wrong will be made right. That's the king. What about the bride? Well, Jesus came for his bride, the church, made up of all those who confess his name. He came for us. And he is what makes us radiant and beautiful. He is not enthralled by our beauty, but in him we are found beautiful. Ephesians 5, 25 through 27 says that he doesn't love us because we are lovely, but in order to make us so by his grace. And just like the bride is given, I know, listen, if you're a guy, you feel kind of weird about this kind of language, I get it. Like talking about the bride and all that, but just don't take that image too far. But just like the bride is given the advice to forget her people and her father and honor him, we are called to turn from all of our allegiances and to fall before him. Jesus tells us that if we are to be his disciples, we must take up our cross daily and follow him. And in Luke 14, Jesus says, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple." And it isn't a command for literal emotional hatred of family. It's an idiom, a Hebrew idiom that says you've got to lay down everything for him, to follow him, to pursue him. That we have to prioritize him above all else, in the same way that the bride leaves her house and her father to go to the king. When the bride joins her husband, it will be what she longed for all her life. In John chapter 14, I'm almost done. In John chapter 14, verses 1 through 6, Jesus says this, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." He comes for us. He comes to us to get us. And on the last day, we will be united with him forever. Revelation 21, verses 1 through 6 says this, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.' He who was seated on the throne said, 'I am making everything new.' Then he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' He said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life.'" Our lives are part of a great big story. Story of a king who looks on his people, on us, with a love greater than any love imaginable, a love that calls for us to turn to him. And it's a story that has a happy ending, the happiest of ending, for those who call on his name and trust in the king. It's a story where happily ever after does exist and is possible. No matter how jaded or cynical we become, how callous and tired and worn down by the world, the ending is promised. The happily ever after is guaranteed. And central to this, a means by which God has given us the way to remind us of this, of his great love, is what we come to now, communion. If you're serving communion, you can go ahead and line up in the back. This is something that reminds us of God's great love for us. Paul says something in Ephesians chapter 5. I made reference to it earlier, but Paul says this in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 and 27. He says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Our King gave himself up for us to make us beautiful, not because we were beautiful, because he was beautiful. And that's what we remember when we come to this table, that our King, our Lord, gave himself for us.